Mr. Phillips.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I want to focus in the first instance on what it strikes me as the ultimately fatal flaw in the certification decision in this case. And frankly, it comes up out of the Supreme Court's most recent decision in Comcast.
Just say one thing I should have said before. Some of your briefs are sealed. I think we're going to try to deal with this just by not mentioning certain things. If we get close to something either side thinks is sealed, warn us to back away, but at least some discussion is going to be necessary, and we don't want to make a mistake in that respect.
Well, I share your concerns, Your Honor, and hopefully there are enough lawyers in here that somebody will recognize if we're moving into untoward territory. As I said, it seems to me that the fundamental flaw in this case that is ultimately fatal is the failure of the expert testimony of the models that were used in this case to satisfy the new standard that the Supreme Court announced a few weeks ago in Comcast. And the key to this is if you look at Rouser's model, what he specifically finds, so he acknowledges that if you take all of the people who were not in the class, that is all of the people who had fuel surcharges that initiated long before the class period started, and who retained those exact same surcharges throughout the entirety of the period, and you take his model and you apply it to that group, which is a significant number of individuals or companies, you will end up with a measure, even under his assessment, of at least an 11.9% surcharge based on his model. Now, that compares to a surcharge overcharge of 13.4% for those who are in the class under these circumstances. So there's not much of a differential there. And obviously, Professor Willig's testimony was that it would actually be 16.8%. But it seems to me that's irrelevant. What really counts is that there is a conceded substantial proof of injury to a group of individuals who are clearly not in the class. And so to lay that, so those are the facts, lay upon that then what the court said in Comcast. This is on page 10 of the slip opinion. But such assurance, and that is the assurance that we're going to be able to demonstrate an antitrust impact, but such assurance is not provided by a methodology that identifies damages that are not the result of the wrong, meaning the wrong that's at issue in the case. The plaintiffs chose.
Let me interrupt you just a moment at this point. Assuming that we agree with everything you have to say, does that lead to a conclusion that we should reverse the district court, or should we vacate and remand for reconsideration in light of Comcast?
I think the right answer is you should reverse the district court for exactly the same reasons why the court in Comcast reversed the Court of Appeals. It didn't remand for additional assessment of anything. It reversed and effectively then brought the case to decertification. I submit that's the same outcome that ought to apply here. The court, if it weren't clear enough from the first quotation I offered up in Comcast, a paragraph later, the court says, in light of the model's inability to bridge the differences between super-competitive prices in general and super-competitive prices attributable to the antitrust violation, it cannot be certification under those circumstances. It seems to me what we're talking about here is exactly what the court said you cannot do in Comcast. What did Judge Friedman have to be sure? He didn't have the benefit of Comcast in front of him when he analyzed this, but he did have the benefit of this criticism of the methodology. And what did he say in his opinion? Not one word about this particular problem. So there's no defense of it at all in the district court certification decision. And then two, what is the plaintiff's response on this? First of all, they attempt to backtrack from their July 1st, 2003 date by saying, well, maybe it spills over to a period before that time. That is, of course, as we show in our reply brief on page 16, flatly inconsistent with multiple analyses offered up by their own expert that there was no conspiracy prior to July 1, 2003. Therefore, that's simply not available to them under these circumstances. And so at the end of the day, what we're talking about here is damages that are not the result of the wrong. That's what Comcast says you have to do in order for models to be used to certify a class. On that basis alone, the court ought to reverse, and we're done. And if there are no further questions on that, I'll move on to additional arguments. Well, at this point, I'm at surplusage.
Before that, are you properly here?
Well, yes, we are properly here for at least
you understand
three reasons. Question. Yes, no, 23F interlocutory appeal. Yes, I understand that, Judge Sintel. Thank you. In the first place, the inconsistency between the holding in this case of certification and the decision in Comcast and means that this is manifest error. Right.
Which ones of them are you here under?
Well, we are most clearly here under, we're under all three, but we are most clearly here, I think, on in sort of the manifest error category. And if you, again, even Comcast helps us on that.
Generally the third or C category.
The third of the three, right. Concluding in Comcast, in footnote 5 on page 9, the court talks about concluding that the model here established damages attributable to the antitrust violation there alone would be obviously and exceptionally erroneous. So the court described exactly the same error in Comcast in terms that are decidedly similar to the third test. So I would start there. Second,
can I just pause about that?
Of course.
How close is that, though, to the question just of whether the model's not very good as a model, and so to a merits question rather than to a class certification question?
Well, I mean, in this case, or are you talking about in Comcast?
Oh, no, in this case. Comcast, a bigger court has already decided that.
Well, I don't think there's any light between this case and Comcast in terms of how you analyze it. In fact, if anything, it seems to me the argument is stronger here that the flaw in this model is so fundamental. Because in Comcast, or at least, you were talking about other violations of the antitrust laws. What we're talking about here is a model that finds enormous damages for people who are not at all, who've suffered no violation of the antitrust laws, and not even there's not even an argument that they suffered a violation of the antitrust laws.
I think it's manifestly erroneous because the district court misunderstood the law of certification, or just that because the district court misunderstood how bad, in your view, the model is.
Frankly, it's both. I don't think he understood, because I don't think he necessarily could have anticipated how the court was going to resolve the issue of what to do with an expert's analysis and how modeling will play out with damages vis-a-vis the antitrust liability that the Supreme Court handed down in Comcast. So he had the benefit of that. But there's no question that had he had the benefit of that, there's no way he could reconcile allowing this to go forward. Indeed, I, as I say, I would have argued that he wasn't entitled to allow it to go forward even before Comcast, if for no other reason than he didn't address this flaw, which seemed to me fairly serious to begin with. But whatever seriousness it had or didn't have prior to the Supreme Court's decision, clearly it has an enormous, it's an enormous problem there. Beyond that, Judge Sintel, to go back to your question, there's still no doubt in my mind that the size of the damages in this case is breathtaking. And under those circumstances, the death knell concept.
Is damages enough to make out a death knell case?
Well, I think the size
you've
of the.
Got, all right, the damages are big. You've got a lot of. You got some big clients here. We know something about their cash flow, I think, from the record. We don't know their market capital, but.
Right. But Judge Sintel,
I think some of them, at least, you had statements to shareholders that, look, this is not going to wipe us out. If we say that that's enough to make out a death knell case, we're pretty well writing a precedent that big class actions are going to always be interlocutorily appealable.
Well, it's arguable that that might actually be the right answer, because the death knell doctrine says.
Doesn't sound like what the statute means, though.
And we've said it's supposed to be an exception. We're only going to be taking these cases in exceptional.
The norm is you can't appeal interlocutorily.
Right, but
you're giving us an exception there that comes pretty close to eating the rule.
Well, I would venture to say that there are not that many class actions that have punitive damages anywhere near the size of this, in this particular case, notwithstanding the size of my clients. And I would also again argue that it's not the question of whether this would drive them out of business. The question is whether this is a damages award of such nature that it would force the defendants to settle otherwise unmeritorious claims simply to avoid the risk that would otherwise arise. And again, to be sure, that's an analysis you have to do.
Something more than simply large claims of damage.
Well, I do think it certainly makes sense to me to think about it in context of that they actually interrelate.
An element of it, but that seemed to me to be all your whole argument on death knell was these are great big damages, and that does not seem to me something. I question whether that's something we ought to write into a precedent.
I don't think
a great big damage is enough to make it interlocutorily appealable.
I guess what I would say is that if you have damages of the order of magnitude we're talking about in this case, that ought to at least raise some concerns about whether this is something that's ever going to get back up on a class certification decision after a judgment. If you tag to that the manifest error that's embedded in here in this particular case, then I would say you ought to then combine the two. I don't have any problem with that. I think it actually makes sense. Instead of evaluating these as three discrete tests, it makes much more sense to me to say, well, they ought to in some way overlap in terms of how they get applied. So if you're talking about a very, very large judgment and a very serious question about whether it's right, if there were ever a case where you'd say you ought to entertain it on an interlocutory basis, we would do it here. And there is, just to complete the trilogy, there is also, I do think, still a conflict in the circuits on the question of the bargaining to the bottom line. The Fifth Circuit has clearly adopted...
Before we get to that, that's... I know, it may be part of this, but I'll still focus on the death knell thing for just one more second. Mm-hmm. Don't we need some kind of statement from your clients that, in fact, they will not be able to go on if this continues? How can we look only at the... If we don't have a statement like that, how do we say anything other than the amounts are really big?
Well, I don't think the test is, can we survive? I don't think that's the standard.
No, I appreciate that. So it has to be that they're not going to be willing to go on after the certification because the risk is too great for them.
But I don't think, Judge Garland, I don't think you can do it the other way around. I don't think you can insist that we have to commit that we will settle the litigation if we lose the
what is? I appreciate that has a different set of problems, and particularly for companies. So where in between, other than just looking at numbers, do we go? Do we not require anything in camera or otherwise from the parties to give us an idea of how significant this would be with respect to the need to settle?
I don't know of any precedent that pushes in that particular direction. But then again, I don't know of very many. I mean, the one thing we do know is that the other side, at least, is not identified. And I don't know of any antitrust case of the magnitude of the one we're talking about here that has actually gone to trial. So you can at least use history somewhat as a guide as to the likelihood that a case of this magnitude is going to end up being tried so that the class certification issue can be available to you at the back end. I would take that as pretty strong evidence that the party's got a very significant incentive to do something other than litigate this.
Isn't it going to be a great big case even without the class certification?
Well, I actually think that cuts against having it class certified. I mean, I think they ought, I mean, that's exactly the point.
the question for us is not the class certified. The question for us is the interlocutory appealability.
Right, no,
that's
I understand.
The one we're discussing at the moment.
Right, to be sure.
So doesn't that cut against interlocutory appealability? You're only saving the difference, which is substantial, but you're not saving the entire potential damage. You're saving the entire potential damages that arise out of the class certification.
Right, but just until that could almost invariably be the case in any situation where you eliminate, if you decertify the class, the litigation still goes forward with the named plaintiffs. Whether it'll go forward or not is a separate issue.
The death knell question.
I'm sorry, Judge.
We're discussing the death knell question.
To be sure.
Which is an exception to the normal rule that it can't be interlocutorily appealed.
Right.
And your claim is, well, the damages are so big they're going to be forced to settle. In assessing the force of that argument, why isn't it legitimate to ask, well, wouldn't there be big damages on the table even without the certification?
Well, because I don't think that speaks directly to whether or not we would be likely to settle an unmeritorious claim or not. It seems to me that the delta that you're talking about between the named plaintiffs' claims and their damages action and the class claims and their damages is so large that the likelihood of wanting to settle to avoid the risk of that is pretty substantial. And again, I can't add more than I've never seen a case like this tried. That would tell me that most rational entities, no matter how large they are, will tend to settle. But again, I don't think I have to win that issue.
You hadn't seen any precedent on the question before us. So the fact that there are not many cases like this doesn't speak to much more than the fact we're talking about an exceptional circumstance, and you have the burden of getting within the exception.
I do have that burden, and I'm willing to assume it. And I would go back to what I said earlier.
Can you go back to the second prong then?
Yes, that was exactly where I was actually going to head to the first prong, but the third prong, I guess it is, and that's the.
You started with the third. You dropped back to the first.
First, then I went to the second. Right, and I'm perfectly comfortable with both the third and the second, and particularly comfortable with the third, for the reasons that the Supreme Court's already articulated in Comcast, that the mistake that's embedded in this class certification decision is an exceptional one by its nature. That's
about the one about conflicts and
risk. Well, and then the Fifth Circuit has, you know, recognized that in cases like this one, where you're talking about enormous negotiations and very complicated decision making, common sense tells you that there will be a tendency to negotiate to the bottom line, and it is very difficult to then say we're going to certify a class across the board. And in this case, there's a lot of evidence in negotiating to the bottom line. Judge Friedman's rationale for excluding that was that he said, well, there's not evidence that proves that those negotiations would have eliminated the entirety of the claim. But that the problem with that is it doesn't take into account the fact that the base rates went up. So the fact that base rates went down, the fact that all-in rates went down in 30 and 10% of all of the cases that we know about tells you that there was significant negotiating to the bottom line that went on in this particular class. And as I read Robinson, that would be a basis on which this class would be decertified as well. There would be a conflict in the circuits if this court were to go the other way, and the court should reject the certification in this case.
Well, that's not the right question, is it? It's not, can you create a conflict by going up interlocutory? It does one exist.
Well, there are other courts.
You can answer that question. Right. You can get there, but not by the way you just.
Right. Robinson is the strongest case on our side of it. There are Court of Appeals cases that say the opposite.
Therefore, there's a conflict.
Right, exactly.
What is the issue? How do you state the issue as to which the conflict?
The issue is under what circumstances negotiating the bottom line is an appropriate basis on which to decertify a class.
And so is that an issue about a fundamental issue of law relating to class actions, or is that a fundamental issue of law regarding antitrust?
Both, actually.
Well, it has to be the former.
Right, right, but it is both. Uh-huh. The question is, in an antitrust case, how are you going to try it as a class action? What's the evidence going to look like? I mean, that's the whole point of the Rule 23. Right, is it going to be more efficient to analyze it this way?
So one of the arguments that's embedded in this is this question that the district court mentioned here, and that was in another district court opinion, that if there actually is a conspiracy, which for purposes of this discussion we have to assume, although appreciate it wasn't decided.
I would contest it.
I appreciate that you contest it, yes. To have these clauses, that alone creates antitrust injury because it requires bargaining down from that, and that when you have to bargain down from that, that creates an injury itself, which is very difficult to overcome for some companies. That strikes me as more of an antitrust issue than a class action question. Maybe that's not good enough from antitrust law point of view, right, but that seems like an antitrust question and an undecided one, okay, but not necessarily a class question.
Well, I mean, I think after Walmart, it's very difficult to segregate the underlying substantive cause of action and the class action analysis. I mean, I think, I think that's even more clear after Comcast, that you really do have to evaluate what's the scope of the antitrust liability decision. But the more fundamental point is...
I just want to skip over Amgen, then.
Oh, I like Amgen.
Well, but Amgen seemed to
perfectly consistent with
seemed to make clear this, that there is a distinct, there remains a distinction between these questions.
Right, but yes and no, because the key to Amgen is the securities law standards that apply, which say materiality is an objective question, reliance is presumed under the circumstances. That's a substantive securities law issue that avoids what would otherwise be a very specific and non-class action oriented proceeding under those circumstances.
Well, what isn't,
you know,
right,
that's the one where you can do it all with one one stroke.
Right, it's presumed, and antitrust isn't a price fixing a per se violation.
Per se violation.
Well, sure, it's a per se.
And it's per se
violation
because some injury is presumed; otherwise, it wouldn't be per se.
To be sure, but you still have to have circumstances in which there is in fact an injury, and we are allowed to put on our defense that all of these people. It goes back to the. I want to be specific to the
I'm
point
only
you made,
responding to the
which
point
is,
about presumed.
Right, but and I understand it. But what you said was at the beginning is the starting place point, and that's the presumption. So you have a starting place point, and therefore that skews the analysis. But that was exactly what Robinson said isn't a violation of the antitrust laws under those circumstances, and that's the same price-fixing theory that's involved here.
I don't think we've ever said that one circuit having decided one way creates a fundamental and uncertain decision with respect to,
No, but other courts have in fact adopted the notion that if you modify the starting point, it has implications. So I'm not, I mean, to be clear here, we're at this stage only talking about the sort of gateway that Judge Santel asked about. It seems to me I should be through the gateway long before I get to Robinson under these circumstances. I think Robinson reinforces the decision that this is not a class that you can realistically evaluate and think about how you're going to litigate a case under these circumstances when you know that there are literally thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of negotiations that are going to be the basis for any assessment of whether anybody actually was injured as a consequence of what is, for these purposes, a conceded conspiracy, but what will also be a highly contested fight as well.
Do we know that they negotiated to the bottom line so that there would be zero antitrust injury?
We know some did. Now, Judge Friedman said he thought that wasn't that big a number, but the bottom line here is he said that he excluded from that.
I know which ones?
Well, we cited, sure, the record has specific, I mean, Exxon, I think, is one of the examples that was specifically in there, and that's obviously a fairly sizable shipper.
And did the district court find that that was true for that one?
Oh, no, the district judge did not. I don't recall it just, the district judge seemed to accept that there were clearly some instances where the negotiations to the bottom line actually, you know, even under his theory, would have eliminated damages. But what he didn't take into account is we're talking about 2003 to 2008, when prices were going up dramatically, where demand for railroad service and capacity for the railroads was rising and the other was shrinking. Under those circumstances, you would expect in general the prices on the base rates to go up. The fact that the base rates then don't go all the way to what the pre-existing base rate is doesn't mean that there hasn't been, that there's still injury under those circumstances. It may well be that there is still no injury. But the bottom line here, and the important point is, that all requires an individualized determination. You can't do that in one stroke, which is what Walmart says you have to do. I mean, this is not a case.
We have to separate the question of injury from damages, right? So the court's not held that individualized damage determinations can't be done under this kind of class. What everybody seems to be agreeing is you have to prove antitrust injury, and that doesn't have to be a particularly large amount. It just has to be antitrust injury. Am I wrong about that?
No, but there is a there's a qualitative. You have to prove the fact of injury in circumstances where it is their burden.
But the fact that there are different degrees of negotiation doesn't necessarily resolve the question. There would have to be some degree of certainty with respect to identifiable parties that they actually had no injury.
Not right.
Right.
That's our point, is that there are probably a lot of plaintiffs who fall in that category, Judge.
That's what the district court seemed to reject at this stage.
Right, but only because he didn't take into account the fact that rates were otherwise going up anyway. He evaluated against the base rates that were pre-existing, not the base rates that would come back in. And we cite specific illustrations of situations where the base rates go up, where we were negotiating both the increase in the base rates and a new fuel surcharge, and the renegotiations came out, and the bottom line rates that came out were, frankly, lower. And remember, again, this is in the context where we're talking about 30%. Base rates went down during this period of time. 10% all-in rates went down. It seems to me under any approach, that suggests to you that there is a significant question about how much negotiation is going on in a way that's inconsistent with the way Judge Friedman looked at it and flatly requires the court to set aside the certification over and above, obviously, the Comcast mistake that was made already in this case. I could go through all of the alternative theories that we have in this case, but it seems to me clearly those are the two that are the strongest at this point. Obviously, if you have questions, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Neward.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Stephen Neuwirth from Quinn Emanuel, Urquhart & Sullivan for the respondents. Your Honors, this is a case brought by and on behalf of corporations large and small, including major corporations like named plaintiff Olin Corporation, that depend on a competitive free market for their success. And these corporate plaintiffs allege that the defendants in this case conspired to use pretextual fuel surcharges to do again what they had only been able to do in the era of government regulation that ended in 1980. That is, collude with each other and impose an across-the-board percentage price increase on all rail freight customers. Now, in this petition for an appeal, we would respectfully submit that what the defendants are actually seeking in this court is a brand new review of the fact-finding by the district court, because all of the issues that have been raised on this appeal, including all of the issues that we heard about this morning, were actually very carefully examined by the district court and addressed in detail in his opinion on the basis of actual evidence that is in the record.
Where in the opinion is the point that Mr. Phillips is particularly emphasizing that the model shows injury to a group, not in the class, that is, to the legacy? I couldn't find it. Is it in here?
Yes. I believe that the district court addressed this in several ways. First,
it's a long opinion, so it'll help if you tell us the page. You can use the JA sites, that'll be the easiest thing.
Yes. I don't know that I have the exact JA site at my disposal, but I will.
We have some other people sitting down at this
table.
I'm sure they can find it.
Thank you. But I believe that the way it was addressed, Your Honor, was in several different ways. First, the fundamental premise of this argument was that legacy shippers somehow should have been included in the class, and the district court found that that legacy shippers somehow tell us something is wrong with the class. The district court found in detail that this was based on an apples to oranges comparison. What the district court explained in great detail was that prior to the start of this conspiracy, Your Honor, it is true that there may have been fuel surcharges, but they were in isolated instances. They were of all different types of formulas.
Yes, so this is what's confusing me. That cuts against you here and in favor of the argument Mr. Phillips was making. If these pre-conspiracy fuel charges were fundamentally different than the more aggressive ones that the district court described, why is it that the model shows injury under those fuel charges for the legacies? And that's the question.
And the reason that the model shows that, Your Honor, is because the issue in this case is not simply the imposition of fuel surcharges. The issue in this case, as discussed in many places in the district court's opinion, is that the fuel surcharges were used as a way to impose an across-the-board increase on so-called all-in rates, that is, the total rate that a shipper pays.
So I'm still having trouble understanding. I thought that was your answer to the argument why the total damages seem to be higher than the damages that could be attributed only to the fuel charge. But this is a different question, I think, or at least it's posed by Mr. Phillips as a different question, and you treat it as a different question in your briefs, which is why does it show that entities that where the nature of the conspiracy is alleged to be an agreement to impose specific kinds of fuel charges uniformly, why is it that the companies that don't have those fuel charges, that have only the legacy ones, why does the statistical model show antitrust injury to those?
It shows it because...
I'm putting the question correctly anyway, aren't I?
It shows it for two reasons. First, it is a matter of fact that is also reflected in different documents that are cited in the district court's opinion that this conspiracy was getting up and running in the spring of 2003.
So this is the argument that you made in the brief, but which I couldn't find in the opinion as an answer to this methodological question. Is somebody over to your left there found it? I'll keep looking. Okay, but so I appreciate your argument in your brief is that this stuff actually started up a little bit earlier. So there seems to be two problems with that. One, I don't see it in the opinion. And two, I'm not sure how it fits with a theory that the problem is the imposition of a different kind of clause than the one that applies to this group of companies that didn't have that clause, and yet still the model shows injury. So let's go to the second part of that question.
Right, and I think that the answer may be in the fact that what was done here was to look at the actual transaction data of the defendants. This case is different from many cases where there's a prediction of what will be shown at trial. Here, the expert looked at all of the transaction data of the defendants and applied it in the model. And what the model showed was that the conspiracy operated in a way to raise the total prices. And so it is not necessarily surprising that fuel surcharges that may have been entered in the months leading up to the start of the class period may have had a similar effect when the companies were already starting to use these new and more aggressive fuel surcharges. What we would respectfully submit is missing from the analysis of the defendants is any explanation of what set of so-called legacy contracts they are looking at. The district court noted that this is an apple to oranges comparison in the sense that prior to the start of the class period, the district court noted that these were applied in very isolated instances and that they were not something that was systematic in any way. And we also know that right immediately before the start of the class period, there were more of these contracts being entered as the conspiracy got up and running. So while we may have picked July 2003 as the start of the class period, which was probably a conservative date to pick, it is just a matter of fact that you would find that if something similar were done immediately before the start of the class period, the damages model would show a similar result.
Could you get recompense for damages that occurred before the class action, before the class period in this action?
We are not seeking that at all, Your Honor. Though anything that happened.
That being the case, doesn't that go to the point that Mr. Phillips is making, that you have a subset of people that don't belong in the class? If you're saying they suffered damages because there was an aggressiveness before the June or July date that you allege, doesn't that take them out of the class?
They are not in the class. These so-called legacy shippers are expressly defined as not being in
those
the class.
Those are the ones who are not in the class.
Right, and I believe if I could try to tie this, Your Honor.
So I understand Mr. Phillips' argument. I hate to personalize this on both sides. I'm going to call it Mr. Neuwirth's argument, Mr. Phillips' argument. Is not that the class includes plaintiffs who shouldn't be in because he understands that you've excluded it, but that the model.
Right.
You would assume that if you get to a model that predicts, that shows injury to defendants who are operating under a contract that no one alleges was itself the result of the conspiracy, then there's something wrong with the model to begin with.
Yeah.
That I think, is the nature of his argument.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, what we're talking about here is a question of what was looked at in the model and what findings the court made about the efficacy of the model. This is not an issue which suggests that there was a legal error in the rigor of the district court's review or in the ability of the district court to reach conclusions based on that review. Now, Mr. Phillips has tried this morning to link all of this to Comcast and to suggest that this type of issue is an issue that Comcast compels this court to intervene with respect to. But we don't believe that Comcast remotely suggests this. First, while Mr. Phillips took some quotes out of context this morning, it is clear that the problem that the Comcast court was dealing with is a problem that is completely absent here. Specifically, the damages model there, quote, failed to measure damages resulting from the particular antitrust injury on which petitioner's liability in the action was premised. And in that case, the expert admitted that his model wasn't designed to and didn't even attempt to measure the effect of damages attributable to the one theory out of four that the district court there had said could go forward. Now, that is a far cry from what is happening here, where we are having an effort to redo the district court's factual and other review of what it is that the competing expert report said in this case.
But isn't there a legal question here? Because I don't think anyone is disputing that you have a common question if you have the existence of a conspiracy. But the issue is whether the antitrust injury and the injury in fact can be shown with common evidence, correct? And I think what he's saying is if you have all these people who negotiated their contracts, that you can't show that with common evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that is exactly what the defendants are saying, and we would respectfully submit that this is really an effort to redo findings of fact, because on the issue of discounting, including in the ways that Chief Judge Garland referred to earlier, the district court did look at this argument that there was discounting supposedly to offset the base rates and found in favor of the plaintiffs on this issue that that was factually not true. And the evidence really supports this. For example, a senior Norfolk Southern executive wrote, quote, "We should absolutely not be deferring any rate increases because we're applying the fuel surcharge." So that's at JA1851. At JA1068, CSX wrote, and in all caps, "No one is authorized to approve a renewal with an increase of less than 10%. No one is authorized to approve a deal without a fuel surcharge. BNSF had a written mandate from the top levels of the company. Marketing teams should not discount a fuel surcharge to raise price." And Don Seale, one of the most senior executives of Norfolk Southern, said that the prohibition on base rate discounting was an inseparable companion to their policies prohibiting fuel surcharge discounting.
And I would say that supports what the district judge here said, that he found no evidence of systematic discounting, right? I mean, that was his basis for saying there's not a problem. But does the absence of systematic discounting mean that you can still show through this common proof, common evidence, right?
Yes.
What I'm not understanding is how that changes the concern that they're expressing here about you having to have individualized proof.
Right, and we understand that question, Your Honor, and we believe the district court, first of all, went further than finding it was simply not systematic. He found at JA4513 that any such discounting was anomalous. His finding was even tougher than all or virtually all standard. He said that any such discounting was anomalous. There is no evidence of this discounting in the record. The defendants say over and over again, large companies are able to get discounts. Well, as reflected at JA0303, even a large company like General Electric tried to get discounts.
Can I ask about this? So I think some of the cases draw a distinction between where you know that someone is in the class who's not injured and where you don't know, and this is something that may require damages kind of inquiry. Mr. Phillips said that, well, we know with respect to Exxon that they were able to negotiate to the bottom line. What is your answer to that?
The answer is that is fabricated. There is nothing in the record.
Fabricated is a little strong, I wouldn't say.
By fabricated, I don't mean to be derogatory, yes, Mr. Phillips, whatsoever. I mean to say that there is no evidence in the record to support that. And the only type of evidence that the defendants put in on these types of issues was a set of 21 fact declarations that they put in at the class certification stage that the district court found on the basis of the depositions of those deponents to be completely without credibility. Just by way of example, one of those declarations made the argument that BNSF during this period actually had 25 different fuel surcharge programs that were applied to shippers in all different circumstances. Well, the deponent admitted at his deposition that 24 of those 25 were never used and that the only one that was actually used was the conspiratorial surcharge that was applied as a result of the conspiracy. This is a case where all of these issues about purported discounting, all of these issues about legacy contracts, all of these issues, for example, about sole-serve shippers, are hypothetical arguments that are not supported by evidence, and the district court did exactly what the Supreme Court has said needs to be done. He delved into the merits in great detail.
Is this your response to the Robinson precedent, or is it separate? You have a separate response to Robinson. Robinson is a tax clause case, right?
Right, and we believe that the answer on all of these issues is the same, that the fact is that what the district court was required to do here was delve into the record and make findings, even on the merits, as necessary to be able to determine whether the issues in this case were capable of being addressed by common evidence. And that is what the district court did. And all of the legal packaging that is now being put on these arguments, we would respectfully submit, is an effort to turn into a legal issue something that was the subject of detailed fact-finding in the district court below. The district court found that these questions were capable of being answered on a class-wide basis, and the district court more than satisfied the standards that they are saying should have been applied. In their briefing, the issues that they raised were that the district court should have applied an all or virtually all standard. Well, the district court more than satisfied that standard by finding at JA4439 that these fuel surcharges were applied uniformly to all or virtually all class members, and at JA4486 that they were uniformly applied across all or virtually all shippers, regardless of whether such shippers were legacy or captive shippers. He looked at the arguments that were being made by the defendants, the same arguments being made here. The district court delved into the evidence in great detail, just what the Supreme Court in Walmart has said needs to be done, and the district court made the finding that any discounting to offset those fuel surcharges, which were the mechanism of the conspiracy, was anomalous. He called it anomalies, rare cases. That's at JA4513. Now, the district court itself, in an opinion that was reprinted at JA777, said that the district court itself didn't view a substantive difference between the all or virtually all standard and the substantial standard that it is said was applied here. What actually happened in the district court was that findings were made to satisfy the all or virtually all standard. Comcast dealt with a completely different issue, and the defendants themselves at JA612 said, quote, the specific facts and theory of impact in Barron are, quote, considerably different from this case. They acknowledged before the Supreme Court ruled that the case was very different, and they said that at a time when the Third Circuit had approved class certification. Though that reality hasn't changed. The problem that the Supreme Court dealt with in Comcast was different, and in fact—
How would you state the question in Comcast and contrast it to the one here?
That we believe that the question that the Supreme Court addressed in Comcast, as reflected in the language I cited before, was, is it possible to have a theory of damages that is different from the theory of liability that is being asserted in the case? And that is why the Supreme Court at 2013 Westlaw 1222646 at star 6 pointed out in such detail that this was a case that had started with four theories of liability. Only one was allowed to go forward, and the theory of damages that was asserted by the expert admitted didn't do with the one theory of liability that was going forward. We have nothing like that here. Here, the damages model deals with exactly the theory that has been articulated since day one in this case. And since day one in this case, in the initial complaint filed in 2007, it was alleged that this was an effort to go back to the era of government regulation when these railroads were allowed to talk to each other, come up with a percentage price increase, and impose it on everyone. And the major corporations and other corporations that are part of this class have had their competition impeded. As I was mentioning before, this assertion that big companies were presumably able to negotiate this away is completely counterfactual.
Can I ask you a couple more questions? Could you talk about the 23F death knell question, why this isn't a death knell case?
Certainly. We believe that the 23F death knell question here is compellingly in favor of the respondents. First, as the panel noted earlier, notwithstanding the assertions that are being made here about the economic impact of this, the defendants themselves have told the SEC in public filings that this case, and these are disclosures that they made after class certification, they said that they expect this case to have no material impact. They renewed those statements in their most recent quarterly filings, which are public.
Their answer to that is that's because they think they're going to win today. I'm not saying they are going to win today, but I take that as my interpretation of Mr. Phillips' brief, that's the reason that they say that.
Well, that would seem to be a large presumption to make in making public disclosures, to suggest that they can count on this court to reverse a finding by a district court of the type that was made here. And we would respectfully submit that while that's a theoretical possibility, we understand that these are responsible companies, that if this case really posed the type of death knell threat that they've written to this court about, would have said something about that in their public filings. But even if that were not the case, as we detail in our brief, the dollars that are at stake here actually represent a small portion of the overall commerce that was at issue. As Judge Sentell correctly noted, these are major businesses that happen to have many, many, many billions of dollars of business a year, and they have many, many billions of dollars of profits. And in fact, throughout the class period, as the record showed, they reported in their SEC filings that the sole or one of just one or two sources of their profits was these fuel surcharges.
But the death knell question is not really about whether it will bankrupt them if they face this liability. It's also about the inexorable pressure to settle even a bad case because of the level of liability.
Yes, Your Honor, we understand that, and we believe that this suggestion, the way they've articulated it, would, as Judge Sentell indicated earlier, mean that you would have to take an interlocutory appeal in every class action, because what is the case where you can't make the argument that class certification creates some pressure to settle? I think that Judge Sentell correctly noted that there would be no way to draw the line of where that rationale stops. And we've understood that the standards in this court, which are conjunctive, not disjunctive, for an interlocutory appeal, are all focused on making this rare, not something that happens regularly. And we think it's very important to note that in the second prong, we think that the manifestly erroneous standard isn't even remotely touched here, because none of the issues that the defendants have identified really bore on how the district court made its decision. The district court was looking at the evidence and the record on all of the issues that were before the court, and the difference between the nuances of this standard, these standards, as the district court itself said, did not have any bearing on the conclusions that the district court reached. Second, the second prong of this test says, it's left out with ellipses in the quote that the defendants have from the Veneman case, but in Larazepan and James, the standard says that it has to be an issue of law important both to the specific litigation and generally. Here, it's not important to the specific litigation because of the findings that the district court made. Judge Garland, in the remaining time, it seems important to answer your question earlier. At JA4486.
I'm not going to let you get away with not answering, do you? What page?
JA4486. The court said that the conspiracy caused the fuel surcharges to be applied uniformly, regardless of whether the shippers were legacy or captive shippers. And this shows why it's reasonable to expect the model to show damages to legacy shippers. We would also note.
Whoa. This is a sentence that says, not only were defendants' class period fuel surcharges more aggressive than before, but they were standardized and uniformly applied across all or virtually all shippers, regardless of whether shippers were legacy or captive shippers. That's the sentence?
Yes.
So I've actually underlined that sentence. I read that as meaning that they got these standardized and more aggressive fuel charges when their other clauses ran out, regardless of whether they themselves were legacy or captive shippers, that is, whether they were from before or captive. Am I not reading that right?
I think you're reading what it says, yes.
Okay, so that's different than the problem that Mr. Phillips is pointing out, which is that the model shows damages not just to legacy shippers who then ended up with the more aggressive fuel charges, but to legacy shippers who have merely legacy fuel clause. Is that right? I mean, that's his argument. So
yes,
is that addressed here? Is that particular point addressed?
Well, we believe it's addressed at least indirectly in the following sense.
Okay.
The district court noted that regardless of whether people were legacy shippers, this would have had an impact on them. And we believe that there is a factual question that can be contested by the defendants as the case moves forward to trial about whether or not the model correctly accounts for the fact that there were legacy shippers prior to the start of the period who the model shows to have had damages. We believe that the reason that happened, as we've said in our papers, is because some of these legacy contracts were entered immediately prior to the start of the class period when the conspiratorial surcharges were already being applied, and therefore, of course, those contracts are going to show results that are the same or similar to what happened during the class period. But the question of whether the model works or not on the basis of that issue is an issue that can be answered commonly for the entire class. It's a question of whether or not this is a good model. And as the Supreme Court said in Amgen, if this question can be answered on the basis of the whole class, it's what the Supreme Court said in Walmart, if it can be answered in one fell swoop for the entire class, then that's a question that's proper for class certification.
You would say Comcast has nothing to do with this issue. Is that what you're saying?
We believe it has nothing to do with this issue, Your Honor, for the reasons stated before.
I hate to end this on what might seem like a sour note for you, but I don't intend it to do that. I want to re-ask the question that Judge Santel asked Mr. Phillips. If we were to disagree with you, if we thought this was manifest error or death knell and questionable, is there precedent for what would be the basis for remanding without vacating? That is the only choice here to, this is not an administrative law case, so that issue isn't. But the question is, send it back to the, is there a precedential way in which the matter could be sent back to the district court rather than immediately revert? I assume that this matters with respect to statute of limitations. That's why, the only reason why this would matter, I guess. Or does it matter for that reason?
Well, I think it matters for several reasons. The first is that this is not a case which is at the infancy stages or even the early stages. It's a case that was filed in 2007. It's a case where fact discovery was completed. The deadline for fact discovery was over at the time of the class certification hearing. This litigation has been going on for many years. We are already in the midst of merits briefing on experts. The defendants have put in 7 expert reports that we're now in the process of having discovery on. There's a schedule set for summary judgment briefing, and the disruption to a litigation that is so far along by a remand on these issues, I don't think can be overstated.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Moreover, we believe that in this case, the district court has already made findings that so clearly demonstrate confidence in the model of Dr. Rauser as compared to anything that was submitted by the defendants, that while there may be a theoretical issue to present to the court under Comcast, we would very respectfully submit that the findings that the district court already made are going to compel the conclusion.
I understand that this actually answers a different question. This is the answer to why we shouldn't do anything against you. But my question, from a hypothetical point of view, was if you have a choice here between reversal in some vacation form and mere remand, would we have the grounds for that kind of disposition?
Well, the very respectful answer is, first,
it doesn't have to be respectful. I just want to know what the law is.
We believe that the threshold inquiry that has to be answered.
Imagine we decided that this particular error, the problem of identifying injury to parties outside of the class, is so enormous that it's manifest. Okay, I'm not saying it is, but imagine that's the case. And therefore, we look at each other and we say, okay, we all agree with that, and now we have to decide what to do. One thing we often do is we reverse. Another thing we could do is just remand the case to the district court to have a better explanation, to address this question, whatever. Then opposing counsel has to decide whether or not to bring it up again. The question is that is that course available to us, or is it pointless anyway? The 23F says there's no stay pending interlocutory appeal, so you could go ahead. I assume there's a stay now, maybe not.
There is not.
Okay, so then you could just go ahead anyway. So the question is, do we have authority to remand, to merely remand, and or is that just a pointless exercise?
I'm certainly not aware of a precedent for a remand absent a finding that there was an issue important to the litigation that needed to be addressed and that there was manifest error.
Right. No, we would. I understand that. I'm trying to use this as an analogy to administrative law cases, and I think that's what Judge Santel was asking the same question, which was, imagine we made this finding that this error in the model is so manifest that unless it's explainable, and the district court didn't explain it, at least not from what we have so far, that it can't alone be enough to get over the problem of proving antitrust injury on a class-wide basis. That would leave it to the district court to explain it, take more evidence on it, whatever, in order to resolve that question. And I'm asking whether that's a disposition that we have authority to do, and whether there's any point to it.
Well, I am not aware of any authority to do that because I'm not familiar with a precedent where, under those types of circumstances, there would just be a remand for a clarification. Moreover, would it make sense to do it, which was the second part of your question? We would say no, because...
Even if the alternative is losing altogether? I doubt that you really mean that.
Well, no. Well, that was a separate question. If the question is,
do we choose reversal or that? For purposes of this question, you only have two choices, reversal or remand.
Well,
I'm not saying that's where we're coming to, but
no,
I'm asking this question.
If the question is... reversal.
I have no doubt what Mr. Phillips' answer is going to be.
Correct. If the question is reversal or remand, we obviously don't pick reversal.
All right. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does Mr. Phillips have any additional time? All right. We'll give you 2 minutes with our usual flexibility on what that means.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honors. Comcast says what it says. I quoted the language. It's not taken out of context. Assurance is not provided by a methodology that identifies damages that are not the result of the wrong. Flat, clear. That's the rule.
Wrong theory. Comcast about a different theory. There were four possible theories. Right. The model evaluates all of them, but they're going forward in only one. It's not exact. They don't have multiple theories here.
Right, but it seems to me that if anything, this is a stronger situation because you're talking about the difference between a context where there is not even an arguable basis for claiming there's an antitrust violation and saying that there are still damages. I mean, the apples to oranges comparison is wonderful from my perspective, because what happens here is you take apples, you pick oranges, you put them through the Rausser model, and what do you get? Orange juice, regardless of which one you put in. Or apples lead to orange juice, Oranges lead to orange juice. That tells me there's a mistake in the model.
A lot better than the sewage sludge case.
Oh, don't I know that? With respect to the negotiation points that Judge Brown raised, I can't go into too many of the specifics because a lot of this is in the sealed part of the briefs, but I would ask the court to look at page 11 in the ExxonMobil illustration. I would ask the court to look at footnote 5, which is a specific negotiation in which ultimately the entirety of the delta was eliminated as a consequence of those negotiations. On the issue of death knell, the only thing I would say here is that I guess it is fair to say that we were counting on this court to do the right thing under these circumstances, and I guess I urge the court to do that. Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take the matter under consideration to figure out what the right thing is.